Now it's time for May Brussel. May, are you there?
I'm on, okay. How are you? Dialogue Conspiracy. We could cover about 5 or 6 hours each week. It's getting pretty heavy. Those conspiracies are all coming together. I remember the days where I used to sit here and talk about just one piece of evidence or something that came up during the week to pretend to Lee Harvey Oswald or Sirhan, but it's all coming down now, and I suppose the Watergate arrests was the most important thing that happened in this country, and we'll be hearing about that in the news. I just have my desk here at the radio station just piled. We could be talking, as I say, for 5 or 6 hours on the news this week about the relationship of the Watergate espionage squad to the Kennedy assassinations and all the assassinations and the way the government is run, because just in the news this evening, you heard the testimony about that Mr. Dean, President Nixon's attorney, lied, and he didn't know that Howard Hunt's desk was in the White House, and yet he's the man who has locked up all the things that were in the desk, the phone numbers and the gun and the walkie-talkie, and he lied to the FBI and said he didn't know about that. And the news this evening had John Mitchell lying at the Justice Department a year ago that he didn't interfere with the ITT case, and now the documents show that he did that. And then the news is coming in, the investigations of the way that conglomerates work. A lot of people don't understand how conspiracies are achieved or what our foreign policy really consists of. And the news, you know, coming in every day right now, if you just take a scissors and cut out almost every article and paste it together, someday you'll have a collage of the way this country is really run by a bunch of liars and espionage squads that have hidden funds and hidden sources of contacts. We'll go into some more details as the show goes on. But the ITT thing shows how when a conglomerate, a company that has copper in Chile and is exploiting that particular country for their own personal profits, realizes that Allende has a chance of winning the election there, they come to the CIA, and Mr. McCone, who used to be head of the CIA, who's on the board of directors of ITT, and they make an appointment with a particular CIA agent, this case Mr. Bro, and they've written documents of the correspondence and so forth, and they say, okay, sabotage Allende, you know, bring economic chaos. The Bank of America in California was in on it, closing their branches, and Houston, Texas, the key states that run this country, Texas, California, and Florida, bring in their troops and agents then that close the banks, and they try to bring civil war and economic chaos. The conglomerates put the president in office. They pay for his campaign. They pay for the publicity and the speaking. They finance that money to Richard Nixon or Spiro Agnew. Puts them in office. And in exchange, they call and they say, well, we've got trouble in Chile. So they use our Central Intelligence Agency. Now, this is all paid for by our tax money, too. They give the president $1 million. This is what the ITT was supposed to give over, $1 million. Then our spooks and the spy teams, the armed forces, our army, go in and begin to sabotage a country like Chile to change their elections and alter it. And if you study the congressional investigations going on right now about Chile, this is exactly what happens in the United States. It's domestic civil war the same way. The conglomerates define who the enemy are, and then they proceed to go about and sabotage every part of that enemy to achieve what they want. There was an article this week of one of the men in the Watergate arrest. He worked with the team, but he wasn't arrested at the Watergate. He was left out of that particular operation. His name is Rinaldo Pico. He's a 36-year-old Cuban exile who's worked with the espionage teams, the Bay of Pigs team that was arrested at the Watergate. He's worked with them since 1961, 1960. And his orders, he came up twice in May and again in June with this team, with Bernard Barker. He was brought up from Miami, and he's told, beat up the hippies, go after the radicals. There's going to be demonstrations in May in Washington. Now, I think the timing was interesting that they came up then, because at the time we did a radio show, just the week, it was the end of April, and I did a show here on the barbecue of John Conley down at the Houston, the Texas ranch of John Conley, and I called it the War Council and compared it to the barbecue at the home of Mr. Murchison the evening before John Kennedy was killed, where Richard Nixon and Clinton Murchison and J. Edgar Hoover were in Dallas, Texas, and the orders were given, go ahead and proceed to kill Kennedy. Well, I compared the barbecue down at Connolly's Ranch the end of April with it being a war council, that there'd be a lot of shifts in this country, and I have the tape of that show. We'll have to play it again sometime. And the next, about 2 days after that barbecue, J. Edgar Hoover was dead, and the next day, Patrick Gray became the acting head of the FBI, and 2 days later, George Wallace was shot and almost killed. Well, at the time that Hoover was dead, these provocateurs were brought up to Washington to demonstrate at around the rotunda where he was lying in state. We talked about this during the summertime. One of the other agents of the Watergate group had spoken about. Well, Mr. Pico surfaced this week, and he told how he was brought in. He worked with Frank Sturgis and Bernard Barco, and six or seven of them flew to Washington and stayed at a hotel and waited for their instructions, and then they were to go out, and they knocked down protesters and got them arrested. Well, these demonstrations in May just happened at the time that Hoover died, and it seems to me that they were brought up for the purpose of showing how irreligious they were, to make a scene with Mr. Hoover lying in state. But the provocateurs were hired and ready. They came in. And Mr. Pico said that he worked with the assumption that it had the official seal and approval of the Nixon administration, that the work they did, in quotes, "I thought we had an official seal from the United States government." Now, what he was doing, he said his team, was a campaign against the hippies. This is what I call domestic civil war. I just finished writing an article about that. Domestic intelligence on the home front. They had the White House approval to go ahead and make war because the hippies are traitors. They are a subculture defined by the administration as traitors, and they bring in their teams from Miami to beat them up, get them arrested, and then they go back home for the next assignment. That was Mr. Pico surfacing about our administration this week. Another person in the Watergate story surfaced, and he's somebody written up in Newsweek, but I haven't discussed him on the show, and there's certain things about him I want to point out, because we'll be hearing in the news for the next 4 or 5 years, I believe, the Watergate story. And one editorial said this week that it's so complicated you need a simple mystery to follow it, and in Watergate 2, when I write that article or the outline of a book, I'll have a cast of characters of about 60 people and identify where they were at the time of the arrest, what job they had, what their background was before, and where they are located now. But one of the new people that surfaced in the last week was a student named Theodore Brill, and he's important because he is a member of the espionage team that was not linked. He didn't know the Watergate group, but Donald Segretti out of the White House, who worked with the Treasury Department, and Dwight Chapin, the appointment secretary, and Herbert Kalmbach, Richard Nixon's attorney. Segretti worked with that team, and he said that he was one of 50 lawyers, I imagine it would be one for each state, that were spread out all over, and Segretti is the only one that was called in, and that's because his phone was directly linked to Howard Hunt's, and he had met Hunt in Miami. But there's also another team that has not been connected by telephone or direct contact to Hunt or Liddy, but is tied to Mr. Malik, in the Frederick Malik, who's now number two man in the Office of Budget Management under Roy Ash now. Theodore Brill was chairman of Young Republicans at George Washington University, set up to infiltrate the Democrats, get them up for drug arrests, and 2 days after the men were arrested at the Watergate Hotel, he was given orders to stop his spy work. That he was hired in May and June, and he was paid $150 a week, and he was supposed to go down to Miami and continue his spying. But he was part of a team that had to stop all operations when the Watergate people were arrested. Now, the surfacing of Theodore Brill now is important because I said that all the quiet that they had in Miami at the time of the Republican conventions and the lack of arrests and confrontations was because the paid provocateurs had to stay home. The people who were there weren't there to make trouble, and it's the government agents that are paid to make trouble, and when they had to stop working, there were a minimum amount of arrests and not a duplication of the Chicago scene. Well, Theodore Brill was told he had to stop his work because the other men were arrested. And he got word, in quotes, the people at the White House were upset. Now, this is coming out of the Washington Post, March the 12th, 1973, if you want to look that up, and March the 11th, 1973. Some people look up these articles and copy them at the library. There's two articles in March 12th and 13th on Theodore Brill. He said that people at the White House, he was told, were upset about the arrest. He was paid by a George Gorton, who Gorton was in charge of the youth at the presidential inauguration and the ball, the grand inaugural ball of Richard Nixon's Spiro Agnew. And Gorton reported to Kenneth Reitz. Now, I save these names because someday if we write them, we want to see where these agents move up and down the ladder in terms of appointments. They're all young, and they have important positions in the administration. And Reitz supplied his information of the bugging and spying that Mr. Brill did, then to Frederick Malick, who's in the Office of Budget Management. It was Theodore Brill from George Washington University, who was paid by George Gorton, who reported by telephone every few days on the spying to Kenneth Reitz, who then supplied it to Frederick Malick. Well, I've claimed that having Roy Ashe as chairman of the Office of Budget Management was preparing for the coup d'etat like they had in Greece, because Lytton Industries was the conduit of funds to overthrow the Greek government and bring in the military dictatorship. And Mr. Malick, we know where Roy Ashe is at, but Mr. Malick, Frederick Malick, was a new name that surfaced at the time of the Watergate. He's heavily involved with espionage, and the important thing is that Theodore Brill was reporting to the number two man in the Office of Budget Management and had to stop his spooking because part of the Watergate were arrested, which means that the Office of Budget Management is involved in the espionage activities that coordinated with the Office of Budget Management. Now, Roy Ashe and Malick were hired by John Ehrlichman in the White House, who also worked with Hunt and Liddy. So you have a tree there with a lot of branches growing out of it, and they don't know each other, some of these agents, but there are central limbs which they know, and it's just a matter of drawing them and putting them on this tree and then maybe hanging them someday, I hope. Not really. Mr. Theodore Brill was to get all of his payments in cash again. We know about those CIA consecutive $100 bills. I keep a file of about 210 different categories of the Watergate. And because I did my 8 years of cross-filing on the John Kennedy assassination, I got in very early. It's complicated to some people to study, and I want to break it down and simplify it. But I only have 210 subjects now and keep adding more. And one of them is $100 bills or consecutive money. This is the way the espionage agents work. And if you want to prove that Richard Nixon is an espionage agent working and funded by the Central Intelligence Agency as well as a conglomerate, you just keep opening this envelope of these consecutive $100 bills. Well, Mr. Brill was paid with his cash, except, and this is the really interesting part, except he got one check, which was an error, and this one check is what caught him up. And tell you, as we unravel the story, he was always paid in cash. And he said that he didn't know any of the Watergate men, but he did work as an undercover man for the committee as a spy. His operations, he said, were super secret, and he passed himself off in the disguise as a member of the peace movement. Now, Mr. Gorton, who hired Theodore Brill, was the coordinator for spying on college students over the country and had infiltrated 38 states, the coordinator of the college campuses of 38 states. He bragged about this position earlier, but then when Mr. Brill was caught, and I'll tell you how he was caught, attention called to him, then Mr. Gorton took it back and said Mr. Brill was the only man that he used as an agent. Well, if you can only find one man out of 38 states, you know that he's lying. But Donald Segretti said that there were 50 more like him, so I'm sure that there's 38 headquarters and a lot of Theodore Brills out there. Now, the motive, according to Brill, for doing espionage work was to cause embarrassment to the Democratic Party. Any embarrassment to the radical groups is an embarrassment to the liberal politics and Senator McGovern. If you can't see now that 50% of this country is sabotaged because 50% are registered Democrats or voted that way at the time of the Kennedy administration or the Johnson administration, and they dropped out at the last election and didn't vote because of disenchantment and propaganda, so much propaganda and scare against George McGovern. But this group is a set espionage group to sabotage the entire electoral process. It comes out every week. These are just two articles in the last 2 weeks. Mr. Rinaldo Pico, who says it was the policy, the official seal of the next Nixon administration, and you have Theodore Brill saying that he is to do anything to sabotage or embarrass any liberal group and make them look like radicals to embarrass Senator McGovern's group once McGovern was nominated. He said his employees were just out of James Bond, and he wasn't kidding, because they are. These aren't just ordinary people trying to find out what the radicals are doing. They are out of James Bond. He described how he'd get paid. He'd meet a woman with a red dress carrying a paper, and she'd hand him an envelope. He'd meet at bookstores, and someone would hand him a book. And in Georgetown, there's a bookstore there, and the money that he had, all of his cash for and filtering the organizations and the youth and for getting them busted, it was paid in particular books. And every 2 days, he'd report back on the telephone, and he was paid by the committee to reelect the president. Now, the interesting thing is that one day he wasn't paid cash out of all May and June every week. This went on for 8 weeks. In 7 weeks, he got cash, but one check, he got $150 a week, was paid to him written. And the General Accounting Office is going into the bookkeeping of the Richard Nixon campaign. And they found the canceled check came back to Mr. Brill, the student, of $150, but the bookkeeping had no record that they had paid him the $150. So that opened up a new set of charges. There's about 22 lawsuits pending against the Committee to Reelect the President and the Watergate suspects. And this opens up a general accounting, another legal problem, because at first the Office to Reelect the President was fined $8,000. They pleaded guilty that Maurice Stans kept in his safe $350,000, which was collected after April the 7th when he was supposed to disclose the source of the money. The committee pleaded guilty to having this amount of cash that they didn't list, and then it ended up in the pocket of the Watergate people, the Watergate Hotel, and when they were arrested. Some of it did, and the rest was in their bank. Nobody was arrested. Maurice Stans wasn't arrested, or Mr. Sloan, or Liddy, who handed out the money, because the feeling was you can't arrest a whole committee, so the committee paid $8,000 to keep it quiet. But now the General Accounting Office has another lawsuit wide open, because the money was used to finance an elaborate espionage plan, but it was not listed. And now they're going to press a suit on the committee, because this money, evidently, there was more money. Now they're coming to the conclusion that there actually was another cash fund, in addition to the cash fund that Maurice Stan have had of $350,000. His safe fluctuated to $750,000 and maybe more. So the conclusion of the General Accounting Office, quoting the Washington Post, is the money was used to finance an elaborate campaign of political espionage and sabotage against the Democratic presidential candidate. The Watergate bugging is only part of a wider political operation of spying, according to federal sources. And that goes back to the article I did in The Realist, written 3 weeks after the men were arrested, that this encompassed the entire electoral process and the whole way that the government's been manipulated since John Kennedy was killed in Dallas in 1963. Well, the Office of Budget Management has Mr. Malik there, but Mr. Malik has not been appointed yet. He has a hearing coming up to see he and Roy Ash before Congress. And a lot of people ask me, what can we do? I told everyone to write to Congress about Patrick Gray, the judiciary, that you didn't want him the head of the FBI. And believe me, the questions and the letters that you write, the things you ask them, I think have an effect, because the committee is voting unanimously that they wanted Mr. Dean to testify even the gentleman that on the committee that recommended Mr. Gray to be the head of the FBI has backed out and said, well, it looks like we can't have him the head of the FBI. There's too many discrepancies coming in. The letters help. Here's a letter that people can write if you want to. It has to do with Mr. Roy Ash, Director of Budget Management, and Frederick Malik, the Deputy Director. And there are members in Congress that feel that Richard Nixon has no right to appoint these men without somebody in Congress checking them out and having them accountable to them. The Senate should confirm their jobs just like they confirm the job of Patrick Gray. These men carry the entire budget and impound the welfare projects, the money for legal assistance in the country, and they are controlling, creating economic chaos just like they did in Chile prior to their own martial law, like they did in Greece. That is what we're having take place. So there are representatives, I'll say the names slowly, there are representatives in Congress. You can write to Representative Tunney. You can write from California. You can write to Representative Wilder, W-Y-D-L-E-R. And you can write to Clarence Brown of Ohio. They want confirmation of the budget officers. Write to them and ask them to please bring before the Congress the question of whether Mr. Ash should be accountable from the Office of Budget Management. Now, there's a gentleman named Representative Jack Brooks who does not want the men to have to be confirmed before the Senate. And he's made a proposal. He comes from Texas, and you might know that because so many of these people that are involved in concealing the role that Mr. Ash is taking there, Mr. Malik, Patrick Gray is from Houston originally. They come from Texas. Representative Jack Brooks of Texas said that if Congress wants a consideration or forces Roy Ash or Malik to be confirmed by the Senate, then he's going to offer an amendment to abolish the budget office and create a new agency that would not be subject to confirmation. That if they insist that Roy Ash and Malik be approved by the Senate, they'll dissolve the Office of Budget Management and they'll give it a new name and let the men stay where they are. If that doesn't give you an inkling of how corrupt these people are, how they want control, and they don't want Congress to question what they're doing there, and Congress is giving Richard Nixon a hard time, even the conservatives like Senator Irvine and Byrd are giving him a hard time for the first time in his life, but it gives you an idea of how desperately this administration needs certain people. They need Roy Ash and they need Frederick Malik, but we don't need them. Write to Tunney, Senator Tunney, write to Senator Cranston and tell them that they shouldn't move the office or the title of budget management. It controls our funds, and that we want to know if these men, see, in order to be confirmed, they look into their background and where the financial holdings are and their government investments, the profits Mr. Ash is making from his shipbuilding yards at Litton Industries and his connection to Howard Hughes and conflict of interest that he has these huge cost overruns, or left Howard Hughes where $43 million was taken from the government and no one knows where it was put back or how it was used, $43 million of our money, while he kept the books at Howard Hughes, and then he goes off and opens Litton Industries, which becomes a very important and very wealthy electronics firm. And he's high up in government. He doesn't tell how he got it started, but 43 is missing that's siphoned from our taxpayers' money to Howard Hughes, to Mr. Roy Ash. And now he doesn't want to stand up and have questions asked, so they're willing to dissolve his committee. There's another person that senators want to oust. These are very, very important. You can keep writing about Patrick Gray if you haven't, and you can write to your congressman about having Roy Ash and Mr. Malik investigated. Mr. Phillips, you know the name Howard Phillips. He's acting director of the Office of Economic Opportunity. He was brought in to chop down and give the axe to all the federal programs. And he's been under steady attack by Congress. And there's congressmen now under the guidance of Ralph Nader who want a suit filed to block his appointment. See, within 30 days, he has to be confirmed, and they want a suit written that he would have to answer certain questions again before the Senate would confirm him. So you can write to congressmen. These are the congressmen to write in this particular lawsuit. Harris and Williams of New Jersey. He's chairman of the Senate Labor and Welfare Committee. Mr. Claiborne Pell, P-E-L-L. That's Mr. Harrison Williams of New Jersey, Mr. Pell of Rhode Island, Mr. Mondale of Minnesota, and William Hathaway of Maine. I don't know if I'm going too fast. These men do not want Mr. Phillips to be head of the OEO, and we certainly should get his qualifications. There have been memos discovered on how he was going to chop these offices as soon as President Nixon was reelected. They intended to do away with these offices, and not telling the people out there, when I'm elected, I will cut away legal aid for the poor and the various programs that they've cut off. Write to any of those four congressmen and say, we support your desire to have Mr. Howard Phillips removed or be brought before the Senate for confirmation. He's serving illegally without Senate confirmation. This is what the Democratic senators are saying. And that's a little homework for this week. Time magazine has a wonderful article, 8 pages long, on Patrick Gray. Mr. Gray is really getting the grilling. He was going to be cooperative and let every member of the Senate Judiciary see the FBI files. But he committed a no-no. He let them know that the raw files that he had showed that Herbert Kalmbach, the president's personal lawyer, had paid Donald Segretti to involve in sabotage. So then the White House said, no, you can't show the raw files anymore. So Gray had to come back and say, well, only the chairman of the committee can see the raw files. And Mr. Gray's having a hard time. But he was handpicked by John Mitchell, and there's no reason why he shouldn't go out. John Mitchell's out, and Mr. Gray should go out, because he represents the intelligence operation, not the political part of our country, not the conservative Republican, but the intelligence operation that was to take over the FBI after J. Edgar Hoover was murdered. And he's a very dangerous person to put in, because he only takes orders from Mr. Kleinitz and Richard Nixon. He does not represent the people, which the National Police or the FBI should be doing. Patrick Gray accounts to Mr. Kleinitz and Mr. Nixon and shows them all the raw reports when Mr. Dean sits in with the FBI reports. You see, the scandal that builds up is that Dean is sitting there with FBI reports of particular people like Donald Segretti. And Mr. Dean hired G. Gordon Liddy, part of the espionage team that was arrested at the Watergate Hotel. He hired him for the committee to reelect the president. And then he tells for certain witnesses like Segretti before they go to the grand jury. He tells them what their questions are being, and he'll be soft on them, and assures them he won't have any problems. He's written all he's been in on all the hearings, Mr. Dean, with the FBI, of material that's coming in from all over the country about the agent that he hired. And then he could go back to those people and protect the periphery of everyone around him who should have been arrested and who wasn't. Patrick Gray is getting a hard grilling. I don't feel sorry for him. He's backing down on the investigation. He said in his hearing this week, he said, the acting director said, every word I say here is listened to by every intelligence agency in the world, and I can't tell you what's happening. He says, I have to stop giving you information because it's listened by every intelligence agency in the world. And Congressman Hart said, I'll be hanged if Moscow or Peking or whoever our new enemies are would be helped by your providing us with memos. What the intelligence agencies in the world are watching is America decaying in front of their eyes. They're just having a blast, I'm sure. As we divide, it's time to divide and conquer in the White House and turn those people against each other with the memos appearing and the testimony conflicting. And I'm sure national security was excused for concealing the truth about the Warren report. Earl Warren had to hide from us the truth of who killed Kennedy for national security. So now Richard Nixon is pleading national security and not telling about the Watergate when his own agents were involved in criminal conspiracies. There's a little article, just to change the subject a bit, about LBJ in his heart seizure, he died down at the his ranch. Somebody wrote in the paper a little article. Where did Lyndon Johnson die? Was it at the ranch or en route to the San Antonio in a helicopter ambulance? And the answer was he most probably was at the LBJ ranch in his bedroom. He suffered a heart seizure and called for Mike Howard, the Secret Service agent, and two others, and he applied a resuscitator, a heart massage, every emergency procedure they knew, to no avail, and there was no sign of life while he was flown to San Antonio. I like the Mike Howard that was there with Lyndon Johnson when he died. I thought that death was a little timely, too, because the very next day, if he hadn't died from whatever causes he did, he would have died from a heart attack, because that was the day that Fred Malik and Mr. Phillips came in and started chopping away the budget, and there went the Great Society down the drain. And Lyndon Johnson kept saying, well, I would have wanted this to go through, but the Vietnam War took precedence. But whatever was left of the Great Society left one day after he had his heart attack. But Mike Howard's name, it comes through my research of the John Kennedy assassination. He was the agent named by Marguerite Oswald in her testimony in Volume 1 as being part of the conspiracy to either kill the president or keep the truth from being told, that he worked with Marguerite Oswald, and it was perfectly obvious to her immediately after the assassination who Mike Howard was. Mike Howard was in Dallas supposedly watching Jackie Kennedy, but the day of the assassination he switched alliances and went to become the agent who watched Marina Oswald. Marina Oswald was not the simple wife of a young fellow in the Marines who was a Marxist. He was an espionage agent, and she was an espionage agent who she only knew him through 3 weeks before they were engaged. They came back to this country, and she was very much a part of the conspiracy, because everything there was against Lee Harvey Oswald was planted with the help of Marina Oswald, or was later she used her testimony, changed it 40 times in order to make it look like he was a guilty person. And right after the assassination, Mike Howard took care of her, took her to the Inn of Six Flags, and then took her over to Mr. Martin's house, where she stayed for 5 or 6 weeks and began to write her contracts for books and money, and the payoff began to come into Marina Oswald to silence her. None of the books have been published or anything. This was just to keep her from talking. But Mike Howard is the CIA Secret Service agent who was very much a part of the Dallas conspiracies, and it's interesting that he should be the one who was with Lyndon Johnson at the time that he had his fatal heart attack one day before the Great Society was buried. We talked a little bit a couple of weeks ago about the shooting of John Stennis and the motive for shooting John Stennis. Senator, one of the reasons was that he had before Congress a bill that all presidential aides be forced to testify before Congress. That's one of the things that President Nixon clamped down this week, that his aides, at the time they serve in the White House or after they leave him, ever in their life can never answer to the Congress. And people like Roy Ash and Mr. Malik should be called before Congress if there's any questions. Henry Kissinger is protected. He's inside the White House under the National Security Council. And the Domestic Security Council has moved all the budget and all the espionage agents and control of the country's domestic matters into the White House now. And President Nixon didn't want his aides to testify before Congress. It's supposed to just sit there and not do very much. Well, Senator Stennis was shot, and of course the cover story we talked at length was a simple burglary, and I showed how it changed many times. Well, now the trial's going on for the hired killers of Yablonsky, the labor leader, Joseph Yablonsky. And the cover story, it turns out, the people that were hired to kill Joseph Yablonsky have testified, and it's in the New York Times, dated March the 15th, this last week, that they were to portray the killing as a bungled burglary, that they were supposed to go in and rob. It was supposed to be a burglary. And then they would panic as a family woke up and they'd split. Now that is what you call in espionage operations a cover story. We talk about that all the time. I wrote about it in my first article. I'm writing about it again. Because 4 years ago, when Yablonsky was killed in 69, the people who were involved had their cover story that if they were found, they were to say it was a burglary. They broke down since, and they've been naming everybody who hired them to do the murder. As a matter of fact, Mr. Prater testified this week that Tony Boyle, who became president of the mine workers, personally guaranteed him that his father would get a pension and that they'd carry through the killings. Tony Boyle, he's been replaced now, president of the mine workers, was arranging these murders. You know, right away in 69, the name Tony came out. The people that were caught said they were doing it for Tony, and Tony Boyle had conflicts with Yablonsky. They were both running for president of the mine worker. But the federal government approves of the murders, just like the conglomerates approve of these murders. If they wanted to find who killed the Yablonsky family, they'd go right in. They had the lead. It was Tony. And 4 years later, he's mentioned all over the place this week. He's mentioned in every newspaper, but the man's still not arrested. The federal government allowed and helped the CIA the killing of Walter Reuther and the Yablonsky family and tried to kill Cesar Chavez. They affect the labor leaders that don't perform in the manner that they want them to perform. So the cover story in the Yablonsky thing that was decided 4 years ago is identical to the cover story of the Stennis shooting that is being revealed. The alleged persons who were supposed to have shot John Stennis were arrested this week, three of them. One was let go. And I think they just pulled this in. Padre Gray was in on that investigation, and I think they pulled in a couple of guys to make it look like the FBI is really doing its thing and finds those people in Washington. All of a sudden, they pulled in these men, and then they hushed it up, and nothing more has come out to prove that they were the ones that shot Stennis. They have what you call suspects, but I doubt those arrests, too. I'm watching them very closely. I think that it's just to show how polished and quick the FBI moves in under Patrick Gray. I don't think much is going to come out of those men that were arrested. There weren't ever three, and they arrested three, so they let that third one go. The evidence will come in later, but I have good suspicions to believe that they're doing this to make it look like the FBI is efficient. And as I say, the newspaper is filled with articles about the Yablonsky thing. There's one of the New Orleans paper that mentions Tony Boyle, but it says he's spotlighted, but they have no plans to seek indictments. Now, that's funny. There was an article this week that really threw me. It was that Richard Nixon, of all people, this is one thing that we can talk about for a few minutes. Richard Nixon is pressing the death penalty. Well, that's true for Nixon. That's okay. That's par for Nixon, just like Billy Graham wanting rape. People allegedly arrested for rape to be castrated. Richard Nixon wants the death penalty, but this is what he's pressing for. He's pressing for people involved in kidnapping, espionage, and treason. Now, the newspaper is just filled with the espionage. He wouldn't have anyone in the White House left today if they started giving the death penalty for espionage. I don't know what he's got in mind. And just to show you, he's really blowing it. Pat Nixon said he's sitting up all night in the Lincoln Room, blowing this hi-fi all night, listening to music. He's changed his role, and I'd love to know what he's listening to. But he's got this loud hi-fi going. I just wonder if he's listening to the Beatles, you know, finally. He won't let John Lennon come in this country as a citizen or even visit without getting his behind chased all over the country, still hiding, trying to find out whether he can stay here because they found some marijuana in his binocular case 4 years ago. So poor John Lennon is lying all over the place, and you can just see Nixon forgetting what he's doing to Lennon and listening real loud. He got, I think, $18,000 worth of records as a gift last week, and he's got this hi-fi going all night, and he's pacing. He can't sleep, and he's got, it's probably a scrambling thing while he's working the Watergate out. But Pat said he's up all night with this thing going, and I think he's blowing his mind because this is what he said this week. He says he was the defendant. He wants a death penalty for the defendant, either who hired someone else to do the killing for him or committed the murder for pay. Well, if he's going to kill the people who hire to kill, he's got, Washington is going to just be clinged out. I mean, there's not going to be one left. I mean, you could start with about 12,000 people right there that he's got all over the country. I'm just doing an article now called Murderville USA, which I say is an outline for a book of 300 people that were hired to kill or victims of hired killers related to his espionage operations in the last 4 years that I've just saved from the news. And he wants hired killers to get the death penalty. We really should get him, you know, to open up the Watergate, not sit so tight on it then, and find out what's happening. When he talks about espionage and treason, he must be trying to say, look, we have nothing to hide. I can't imagine why the man's coming out for this death penalty now when all of his administration's involved in espionage. He can't even deny it, and he wants a death penalty. I think what I really think, in seriousness, is he thinks and he knows he's going to be killed, and he's warning, if you kill me, you're going to get it. See, like, be careful now, because if you're hired to kill me, you're going to get the death penalty. I mean, there must be some real paranoia or desperation in his proclaiming it, because I cut out this week's newspaper about 20 articles with heavy repetition of getting, you know, the death penalty back on. And I think Nixon's really getting nervous, and he has his reasons, you can believe. Oh, I wanted to read today the Rochelle McGee trial. I have a few minutes. We may run over a little bit. Just a little bit for the Rochelle McGee. I'm going to do a whole program on it. I keep saying if the news doesn't come in too heavy. We haven't done a whole program, and the trial's about to wind up in San Francisco. Rochelle McGee was arrested at the time of the shootout. Jonathan Jackson was killed, and Angela Davis had her trial separately, and he was arrested as part of the shootout of killing Judge Haley, and he's holding on to his life there. He was not involved in that killing. The trial would have been over in 10 minutes if they had used the Lewis Tackwood allegations. Tackwood came out in 1971 and described how the shootout took place, involved the Los Angeles Police Department. He described the weapon, the bullet that's missing, the autopsies on Jonathan Jackson, the direction of the bullets. And I was in touch with Rochelle's attorneys up there, Caro, and the whole team, but they were so afraid to touch Tackwood's allegations because it would open up a whole bunch of other things that are happening in this state. But I got a letter from Mark Schwartz, who covers the trial every day for KPFK and the news. And this week I got a letter in which he said, in quotes, the testimony is coming out like Tackwood said it would, you know, that after all this time, the shot seems to have come. This is what in the testimony this week. The shot seems to have come by someone outside the van after all the other shots had stopped. And Rochelle doesn't remember any of the shots coming from inside of the van. And the letter I got is the only theory which substantiates Rochelle's testimony is Lewis Tackwood. In fact, one of the .38 San Quentin revolvers which could have killed Haley is missing. So the trial is winding up pretty good for Rochelle, and I hope he gets off. But I just want to read you for a few minutes a few pages of the transcript of what happened in the van that was sent to me this week. I got it from up there. It was a transcript of March the 13th, just this last Friday. And the person answering the questions is Mr. Harris, the prosecutor who tried to prosecute Angela Davis. He's asking Rochelle questions because Rochelle was in the van, and Judge Haley had his back to him and was sitting there. And I'm going to read this very quickly. Harris says, isn't it a fact, he says, that you were stating that the shotgun you had shot Judge Haley? And Rochelle says, I don't know who shot him. You weren't in the van? Right. Didn't he have his face torn away? Rochelle says, I didn't see his face, but you've seen pictures of it, haven't you? I haven't seen the pictures. Well, what happened to Haley? And Rochelle says, Judge Haley's face was not like that in the pictures when I saw him in the van. He had his face when he saw him. His face hadn't been shot yet? No, it hadn't been shot. There was some blood on him, but his face hadn't been shot. See, Rochelle said he was shot in the shoulder and stomach. His face hadn't been shot off when he saw him. Harris, you think he was shot somewhere else? I'm sure he was. And when you saw him in that position he was in, well, he was waving at the front, and he was yelling, don't shoot, because the guards from the front were going to shoot at him. Was he more or less in the same position he's in the picture? No, nothing like that. You've got the wrong angle. Well, what angle was he laying in? Well, he was laying towards the front of the truck, back up toward where McClain was sitting. And Harris says, Judge Haley was up near McClain, up around there? No, he was not up there. He wasn't up near there. He was more in the middle of the van. And Harris says to him, and he was leaning against the wall? Right. And he was knocked up against it? You saw him knocked? And Rochelle said, I was looking at him. You were looking at him? Yeah, he was sitting there, right over there by the back of the van, by the back door. Was in the corner? No. I said, more in the center of the van. You were in the center of the van. I was at the back of it, and he was at the center. And you saw Haley, and he appeared to be dead. Well, he looked up from the wall. And what happened to his face? Nothing was happened with his face then. Nothing wrong with his face? No. What happened to the shotgun? The shotgun was around his neck when I observed the gun. Was it hanging there? Yes. And Judge Haley hadn't released the gun yet? No, he hadn't released the gun. Now, he says after it was pulled off, after he asked about the traffic of the van, and the van had stopped. Harris says, and during that period of time, Haley hadn't taken that gun and pulled it off the tape? No, he didn't do that. There's no reason he couldn't have done it, is there? And the attorney, Mr. Carroll, objected. Judge Haley, he was implying he could have taken off if he wanted to, because he was building up the question, if he could have taken off the shotgun, would he have killed Rochelle, who was in the van? And the question was, but you were prepared to take that shotgun, weren't you, that was available? And Carroll interjected and said, Your Honor, I don't understand this question. And he said, let me paraphrase it. As far as you were concerned, Mr. McGee, when you were in that van, according to your testimony, when you saw that shotgun, you could have taken it from him? And he said, I didn't see it. I didn't have it. I didn't take it from his neck. I didn't have the shotgun. He says, but you left it there? And he says, I didn't have that gun. And he showed him a picture of it again. Now, he says, before Judge Haley was dead, was he moving? He was moving when I saw him. And Harris says, and he could have taken that shotgun and taken it off his neck. Isn't that right? And he said, he could have done it, but I didn't see him do anything like that. Harris says, I didn't ask you, could he have done it? Is there any reason he couldn't have taken it off? And Rochelle says, I didn't see him. And Harris says, was there anything to prevent him from doing it? I don't know. I didn't see him doing it. But he could have done it. Isn't that right? And he says, there's no reason he couldn't have taken that gun and used it. And Rochelle says, I didn't see the shotgun at the time. My mind wasn't on the shotgun. As a matter of fact, Mr. Harris, I didn't think about the gun. He said, there were a lot of guns there, and I wasn't thinking about the shotgun. And he says, and you were facing an effort by the police to stop you from leaving the courthouse. He says, yes, the police were on my mind quite often, and you weren't prepared to kill if you had to. He said, I'm saying I intended to kill no one. Isn't it a fact that with your state of mind was such that you had the intent to kill, that you had it from the moment Jonathan Jackson came in the courtroom? Rochelle said, no, my intention was not to kill anyone. Killing someone was not going to help me prove what I'm proving this very day. Harris, but it would have helped you and made you feel better. Wouldn't you feel better? Rochelle says, you're stating that. And Harris says, I'm asking you, McGee. And he says, no, I'm going to tell you once more. My intent was not to injure anyone. Harris, but you hated judges on that day, and in that van particularly? Rochelle McGee said, what do you mean, hate judges? He says, that's what I said. Don't you hate judges? He said, I hate one in particular, and his name is Herbert Walker. He's in Los Angeles, the one that had sent him into prison in the first place. I hate him as much as I hate you, Mr. Harris. And Harris said, do you hate Judge Haley? He said, no, I had nothing against Judge Haley. And Harris said, wasn't it enough that he was a judge for you to hate him and for you to kill him? And Rochelle said, no, I see what you're going after, but it won't work. And whereupon the courtroom broke into laughter and disrupted, and Judge Colvin said, there's nothing funny about these proceedings, and the court was adjourned. Okay, that's dialogue conspiracy today. That's the Rochelle McGee.
Okay. Thank you very much, May, and we'll be looking forward to seeing you next week. This is KLRB FM in Carmel. We'll be playing some music for you.